From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Philippe Gély, the U.S. chief correspondent for Le Figaro. Our moderator is Washington-based CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Yet another deadly school shooting in the U.S. state of Florida claims 17 lives, wounds many more, and raises once again the issues surrounding the ever-worsening gun violence in America. Warning of increased Russian meddling in the 2018 midterm elections, U.S. intelligence officials confirm that the threat is clear and present, but the Trump administration's strategy for how to respond remains unsettled. South African President Jacob Zuma resigns in a cloud of scandal. What's next for the nation with the largest economy on the continent and some of its largest problems? And the games of the 23rd Winter Olympics are in full swing in Pyongyang, South Korea. Along with the athletics, politics and diplomacy are also in the spotlight as North and South Korea compete and cooperate, opening the possibility of improved relations between the two countries. Panelists, this is a subject that I truly wish was not on the agenda, but let's try to dive in and we will try to make some sense of it, but see if we can bring some facts to light. Tracy, if you would sort of give the background of what we know at this time about the incident and about the perpetrator of this horrible event.
Well, what we know is this former student at the school returned with a vengeance and with guns and killed 17 people, wounded a lot more. There are various reports that he was mentally unstable, that he had, various issues. His mother had just died and so forth. He was, I think, 19 and able to get guns and able to get a semi-automatic, I think, a rifle and mow down a lot of his former schoolmates.
Yes, he was 19 years old. At an age where he couldn't get a beer. Philippe, we've seen this over and over again in incidents like Las Vegas, the nightclub shooting in Orlando and another part of Florida, not very far away, Newtown, Sandy Hook. What is similar in this incident to these other things and what maybe is different about it, sort of focusing on the locations of it, the target, who was targeted, and the weapons that were used?
Well, schools are obviously a frequent target. I know there is some discussion about the figure of 18 school shootings since the start of the year because, this number is a little bit inflated. There was instances where there was just gunfire in a school area without anyone being threatened or even injured. Young people targeting their classmates, this is not the first time. The common trend, I think, is this use of military weapons. This is something you don't find anywhere else. This is such a horrendous American routine right now. And I don't see any deepest cultural gap between the United States and Europe, for instance, than on this issue of guns. I mean, we consider healthcare as being a human right. We don't consider having a gun as being a human right. And that's probably the simplest definition of the cultural differences. There was a time in the Middle Ages where a free man had to have a sword. You know, that was an inaccessible right. But we have modernized things since then. And in this country, there is this huge issue of, 5% of the world population having 42% of the civilian-owned guns in the world. And that will take a very long cure, but what you see is a president and a Congress who don't even want to acknowledge the problem.
Let's talk a little bit about the response, Tracy.
I agree completely, and I'll revert for a minute to the fact I'm someone who lived outside of this country for most of the last two decades, and to come here and see that this is a place where you have probably the greatest access to guns in the world and the largest number of these kinds of massacres going on. That's an undeniable connection, and our politicians will not talk about it, much less begin to take action and, enact stricter background checks or access to, you know, certain kinds of guns. You know, we saw President Trump's comments yesterday. He did not mention the word gun.
I want to talk in specific about the response of the president on Twitter and in his spoken remarks. On Twitter, so many signs that the Florida shooter was mentally disturbed, even expelled from school for bad and erratic behavior. Neighbors and classmates knew he was a big problem, must always report such instances to authorities again and again. And in spoken remarks, we will do whatever we can to ease your pain. No child should ever be in danger in an American school. You have people who will do anything to help you. These remarks are put next to the fact that early in his presidency, Mr. Trump approved the removal of an Obama-era regulation intended to prevent people with mental disabilities from buying guns. So my question, and I'm going to throw it out to the both of you, the administration seems reluctant to take on any form of discussion on gun control. So what does the administration really think is the problem, and what does it think may be the solution, if there is one?
I don't truly think that they think that the problem is mental health. It's not a mental health issue. I mean, you have plenty of places in the world where when someone turns crazy, he may put his hands on a stick and maybe hurt someone. There are countries where you have criminals have weapons, the terrorists have weapons, and police people have weapons.
Right, some countries that we think of as quote-unquote lawless countries.
But if anybody who turns, has a nervous breakdown can just kill 17 classmates, then you have a problem with guns, not with mental health only.
Tracy, I'll throw it out to you. Is this a mental health problem? Is it a gun problem? Is it another problem?
Well, mental health is an issue, but I think it's a gun problem. The access is like nowhere else in the world. I used to live in Mexico, and they kept begging the United States to stop sending weapons, guns, because it's illegal in Mexico for a private citizen to own a gun. And it's just unfathomable that you can't discuss having some restrictions on certain kinds of guns. You know, this kind of weapon that this man used is not a hunting weapon, as many even congressmen acknowledge. And so why can't we have a discussion about that? And I don't know if it's fear of the NRA or what it is, but, as you point out, even this administration, they talk about mental health, but then they do, in fact, the opposite. So,
again, the NRA being the National Rifle Association, sort of the leading gun lobbyist here in the United States. And let's take the discussion that way. Much of the debate and discussion on this issue has centered around the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution, which says that essentially that every citizen has the right to bear arms, more or less. And again, there's a lot of debate about what that means and who should have one and what type of weapon and that sort of thing. That's where the debate is. But it's interesting that in the aftermath of this shooting, many law enforcement officials are calling for lawmakers to give law enforcement the right to detain people based on provocative postings on their social media accounts, which this perpetrator had many of, many really disturbing things that they found on his social media accounts. This widens the discussion, it seems to me, from the Second Amendment to include the First, which guarantees free speech. So is law enforcement based on the social media of individuals a common sense move, in your opinion, to sort of predict these types of things? Or is that a violation of First Amendment rights, of civil rights, of free speech? Is that a practical way to go?
It's tricky. It gets very tricky, doesn't it? Because, we do have the, very revered First Amendment. I think that law enforcement just has to be careful and cautious. In this case, it was fairly explicit. He said he wanted to be a school shooter. And so that's fairly explicit. And I think it might have merited an investigation, but you really have to be careful because, First Amendment, freedom of speech, all kinds of speech, all kinds are protected. And I think law enforcement just has to be very careful and kind of judge case by case how they pursue that.
I think you have to wonder what would happen if this young guy had been arrested before doing anything and just for, posting stupid comments like, I plan to be a professional school shooter. Mm-hmm. Well, he would argue that was a bad joke, that he was stupid, that he's only 18. So nothing would happen. And I see all those discussions like as being, efforts to avoid the core issue of what we should do, how to banish some sort of weapons, how to forbid the sale of bump stocks, of all these kind of things. I mean, there was discussion in the Congress after the Las Vegas shooting in October, and nothing has been done. And Governor Scott in Florida and Senator Marco Rubio are A-plus graded NRA people. So nothing will happen. And this is all talking, chatting, and the next time, I'm sorry, you will have to ask the same question at this mic.
Yeah,
and
distractions.
It really is distractions, and this is one of the times I kind of wish I was on the panel instead of moderating. But again, we have this situation in Florida where a 19-year-old can't buy a beer but can buy an AR-15 battle weapon. And I wonder, it occurred to me, I wonder how lawmakers would behave if the gun rights lobby, the National Rifle Association, decided to, instead of spending millions of dollars funding political campaigns, that they use that money to help offset the immeasurable loss inflicted on the families of these heinous acts, and instead sent thoughts and prayers to candidates. It would be kind of a nice switch to me.
It would be.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break right there, and we'll be back with more of Issues in the News in just a moment.
This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. A reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Philippe Gély, the U.S. chief correspondent for Le Figaro. Our moderator is Michael Williams, Washington-based CBS radio contributor.
Let's move on to the intelligence community and the recent testimony warning of Russian meddling in the upcoming elections. Leaders of the intelligence community said that the United States is under attack as it relates to the nation's cybersecurity heading into the 2018 midterm elections. FBI Director Christopher Wray, CIA Director Mike Pompeo, and National Director of Intelligence Dan Coats joined other intelligence heads offering testimony on worldwide threats facing the U.S. and its allies on Capitol Hill. Philippe, I'm going to start with you. What was the message really about from the intelligence community about this Russian threat to the U.S. elections? What were they saying in a nutshell?
It was striking to listen to those people, most of them appointed by President Trump, telling him that he's wrong and that he should acknowledge what he has not acknowledged yet, which is this Russian meddling in U.S. election is a reality, has been a reality in 2016, will probably still be in 2018. And again, we have a situation where the President of the United States doesn't want to acknowledge something he thinks undermines his victory. But you have to wonder what would happen in the real world. Putin's forces, for instance, invade Crimea, Ukraine, Georgia before that, with unmarked uniforms. And you have the President of the United States saying, well, he denies it. And I tend to believe him, you know? So end of the story? Is that the end of the story?
Interesting thought and interesting premise that could actually happen. Tracy, what's your take
on it? Well, it's remarkable. Again, as with the gun shooting, as with sexual harassment, you know, there is a leader here who doesn't lead. I mean, even the vice president, who tends to be, you know, in lockstep with Trump, even the vice president talks about this, you know, severe problem of Russian meddling, and President Trump still does not acknowledge it. So I think the congressmen in the hearings were very frustrated that more has not been done to protect the U.S. system from this kind of attack and interference. And there's, again, no leadership on the issue.
The threats themselves seem to be focused on two fronts, the manipulation of public opinion through social media and the manipulation or potential manipulation of actual vote counts. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made a statement saying that this type of tampering seems almost like an inevitability, he seemed to say. Have you heard anything, I'll go to you, Philippe, about the White House or anyone else sort of even beginning to formulate and articulate a plan for both defense and or retaliation of these types of things? I know we've already said that there's not acknowledgement at the highest level, but underneath, yeah, with the workaday intelligence community, are you hearing anything?
Not really. It's a very strange situation where you have the president again, not acknowledging what's going on, but everybody else around him almost does acknowledge that there is a problem. I haven't heard that there is a comprehensive plan, although it's also very difficult to set up. I mean, this is very complicated matter. You have bots, automatic accounts on Twitter, on Facebook, that look like real users, that are very, very useful tools to influence people and that are part of a flow of legitimate conversation between real people. So it's very, very difficult to fight that. It would take probably a lot of agencies and probably several countries, probably an international plan to try to fill the loopholes here. And again, you need leadership, as Tracy said, and we don't have that right now.
Tracy, I'll give you the last word on this one. I believe the ultimate goal of this election tampering, and also by China, the Russians are not alone, is destabilization of Western democracies. If that is, in fact, the goal of it, is it working?
I think so. I think it is. I think we've seen the U.S. position in the world greatly diminished, in part by this president and his policies, but also his refusal to acknowledge so much of what is actually happening, as is the meddling or his withdrawal from Paris, the climate agreement, and other things. I do think that the U.S. position worldwide is being diminished, and that would be Putin's goal.
Let's move to South Africa, where Jacob Zuma, president of South Africa since his election in 2009, resigned. Zuma actually struck a relatively light tone at his resignation speech, sort of laughing and joking with reporters. In that speech, he blamed violence and division within his own ANC party as the reason for his departure, but most observers have a different take on that, of course. Tracy, I'll throw it to you. Can you describe sort of the forces that led to his ultimate resignation, his demise?
Well, I think the allegations of corruption, his vast network of patronage, I think finally took him down. Many people see him as really having dragged the ANC down to the once revered ANC down to a position of scorn, and he and his family were enriching themselves dramatically while so much of the country was mired in poverty. The question is, though, will his successor, be able to change much of what is our structural problems in South Africa? And it's just kind of a sad, not a legacy, but sort of an indictment of, this is a country that we all, so much wanted to succeed in post-apartheid South Africa. And unfortunately, it's really been dragged down under Zuma and other factors. So the future now is the big question.
I think you framed that very well. There's sort of 10 years of this Zuma period have left the country with some really big challenges. Cyril Ramaphosa has already been sworn in as his successor. Philippe, can you give us some background on Cyril Ramaphosa, the person that he is and the president that he will be?
Yeah, well, he was born in Soweto in the townships. He went to jail as a young a militant. He was a unionist. He was also kind of designated by Mandela to be his successor 20 years ago. He was part of the negotiation with the apartheid power in order to bring it down and get to the first multiracial election in 1994. He was then ousted by the party, basically, after Mandela's death, and he became a very successful businessman. I think his wealth is over $400 million, so it's not bad. And he's made a comeback in politics, which is probably his passion from the beginning, through being the president of the party and the vice president of the country. And so I see Ramaphosa as the last chance of the ANC. But the challenge is huge. As Tracy said, I mean, unemployment is almost 30%. It's 60% among young blacks. there are 19,000 murders a year in South Africa. So this country that was the beacon of Africa and then the most successful economy and the richest in Africa, and so it's all on Ramaphosa's shoulders now to try to get rid of this system of corruption, to solve very, very difficult issues. There is a drought that is very severe right now.
Right.
I mean, so many things to do. We have to hope that the guy is honest, dedicated, and wants really to help his fellow citizens.
We can only hope, because I have a great affinity for that country. I certainly do. Let's talk a little bit about politics and diplomacy at the Olympics. So the Winter Olympics are on now. My favorites, because so many of the events seem particularly impossible to me. But they're in full swing. And the focus is on the relations and interactions between host South Korea and rival North Korea. So we had the specter of South Korea and North Korea walking together, having teams together, being attended by a representative from North Korea. Tracy, I'll throw it out to you. Does this represent a significant thaw in relations between the two countries, and does it bode well for continuing talks after the games?
It's an important thaw. We will see how significant it is in the long term. You know, I was just with Secretary of State Tillerson in Latin America, and even there in those countries, North Korea kept coming up, and he kept talking about North Korea and getting those countries to join the U.S. Pressure campaign. And towards the end of that trip, which was about the time that the Olympics were beginning, he started saying things, you know, we would ask him, well, you know, will the U.S. will be in South Korea, North Koreans will be there, will you talk to them? And he said, we'll see, you know, which was kind of a huge breakthrough. It wasn't, no, we won't talk to them. It's like, we'll see. And then Mike Pence started saying the same thing. And he, of course, led the U.S. delegation to South Korea. So I think that this was an attempt by the United States to sort of blunt the efforts of North Korea to drive a wedge between South Korea and the United States. And I think that's what the North Korea objective has been here, to show that, you know, we can talk to South Korea and, you know, leave the United States on the sideline. And so I think the U.S. was trying to say, well, we also are willing to talk. I don't think they're really there yet, but I think it was all sort of symbolism more than anything. It's been pretty quiet in North Korea these last several weeks. We'll see. We'll have to see what happens next. It's hard to believe that Kim Jong-un is really going to divert from his program of nuclear armament. But, you know, talking at least helps.
And I'll give you the last word on this one, Philippe. The idea of North Korea sort of changing tactics and going into negotiations and talks and things like this, do you think that they're changing tactic, or is this like an additional tactic, sort of a stall tactic?
I think it's an additional tactic. I think it's a very smart move on the part of Kim Jong-un. He played tough with the nuclear tests, missile launchings. Now that he can affirm that his country is a nuclear power, he plays soft. He sends his sister to the games, and it was interesting to see how the South Koreans were fascinated by the Kim Yo-young. The American attitude is still quite confusing, I think. I've heard an advisor of the president saying that he had submitted several options to the president, some of them not military.
But
I quote,
military still seems
But when you listen to people at the Pentagon, it's much more, much softer. Also at the State Department of State. So, and they acknowledge that negotiation would be good, but they will never get rid of, they will never get to denuclearize the peninsula. They might lead to containment. They might lead to some sort verification system, but it will be very hard to get Kim Jong-un get rid of his nuclear weapons without going to war, and we all know the cost of that sort of conflict.
War. Absolutely. Again, very complex issues, but that's all the time that we have. Thanks to Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Philippe Gilly, the U.S. chief correspondent for Le Figaro. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor in Washington. Thanks for listening.